Hello and welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm not Evan Swartz-Draver. I'm Baron Soka. I've fired Evan finally, and we'll be taking over the podcast at least for today. Evan might be back for our next episode. We'll see. I'm recording from lovely Aspen, Colorado, here at the Tech Policy Institute's conference about tech policy. And I have with me today Robin Hanson of George Mason University, the author of The Age of M. Robin, welcome to the show.
Age of M, Work, Love, and Life When Robots Rule the Earth.
So what's M?
M is short for emulation. It's one of the kinds of artificial intelligence. So the book is about what happens if the first kind of human-level artificial intelligence comes from brain emulations. A brain emulation is where you take a particular human brain and you make a computer model of that brain with the same sort of connections, the same kind of cells, but now it's a computer model that processes signals the same way.
So that's a little different from what most people talk about when they talk about the killer AI or the idea that superintelligence is going to displace humans. You're talking about something that's more of, shall we say, an adaptive innovation. It looks more like humans.
I think people are usually not entirely clear what they mean. They say something really smart and they're not very specific about what they have in mind. But the most obvious scenario is to take the kind of software we've been writing for 70 years and imagine that gets much better. So that makes a more specific scenario. And yes, this is different from that scenario. This is not code that you write and then you can go look up line 476 and see which characters are there and edit it. This is you take a messy brain and you just make a copy and turn it on.
So it's software that would be more complicated than any single coder could understand, just like the brain itself.
Well, yeah, it would be exactly as complicated as the brain itself because it's just a copy. So the idea is to port the software that's already in the brain. So today, if you have an old computer running software that you like and you want to make it run on a new computer, you could just try to stare at the software, figure out how it works, and write new software that acts the same way. Or you can just write an emulator for the new computer that makes the new computer look like the old computer to the software, and then you could just move the software over. So the idea is to do that for the human brain. Make an emulator, make computer models of how each of the cells work, and you just copy the whole structure over. You don't understand it. You just copy it piece for piece exactly the way it is, and if you get all the parts right and you've got the copy right, then it should just work, even if you don't understand it.
So it's a little bit like playing your old Super Nintendo games on a current
exactly.
PC, just
right.
Another emulator.
Exactly.
Okay, So that's the first difference here from what some people talk about when they talk about superintelligence. But there's another big difference you draw. A lot of people think about the future as a kind of the big takeoff. There's going to be some sort of huge acceleration, and then it's going to explode, and we don't know what comes beyond that. You've got a chart that you just showed us at lunch today, and that draws a very different model of progress and economic growth. You draw sort of ratchets. And you envision there being bursts of change, and then maybe things don't change quite so dramatically after that. So that is that the age of M, a short burst? How long are we talking?
Well, so I'm making an analogy to the age of foragers, the age of farming, or the age of industry. So each of these was ages where the economy doubled roughly 7 to 15 times. And during each age, there was relatively steady exponential growth. But there were these short transitions between ages now where the growth rate increased by 50 to 200 times. And those are what you might call singularities or sudden transitions, but they are transitions between ages. So there was the Industrial Revolution, and maybe that took several hundred years, but by now we're in the Industrial Age and we're doubling every 15 years. And now we're in the Age of Industry. So my book is focused on the Age of M, mostly about what happens after a transition to the next age. So it's really harder to talk about transitions. They're harder to predict. There's just more disruption and anxiety there. But once it gets going, then it's easier to predict. And I've written the whole book trying to describe what happens.
And you're focused on trying to describe predictions that you have some confidence you can defend.
That's right.
So you don't really get into, in great detail, what happens after this age. You're just focused on what this age looks like.
Right. I'm trying to show you can say a lot more than most people think you can, but I am being opportunistic about saying what I can and shutting up when I can't. So I do not tell you about music fashion. I will not tell you about clothing fashion. I can't predict those things.
Well, it's something we're not very good at on this show. At least I'm not. But I'm glad someone here can do that. So you draw a distinction between short and long in thinking and prediction. What does that mean?
So I have a lot of friends who are into technology and see themselves as futurism. And on my Facebook and other feeds, they're constantly telling me about the latest tech demo, the latest gadget, or the latest, result that somebody thinks they have. And that's not really long-term thinking. That's really paying attention to very short-term fluctuations. Now,
even if it's next year's model we're talking
even
about?
Even if it's next year's model, exactly. So honestly, if you want to be thinking about a long run, you should be looking at long-run trends. You should be looking at long-run issues and not really getting fixated on every new tech demo or every new gadget that shows up every few weeks.
And what's your idea of long run?
Well, here, my book is about sometime in the next century or so. The age of M shows up on that timescale, not in the next 10 or 20 years. But a lot happens once it shows up.
And how long does it last?
Plausibly just a year or two, because that's as long as it takes to go through as many doublings as the previous eras have seen if the economy doubles every month or so. So if an economy doubles every month, it only takes 7 to 15 months to do 7 to 15 doublings. And after that, plausibly something else might happen.
So how much faster do we think these software emulations of our brains would work than we work?
So they could run at a wide range of speeds. So there's a linear relationship of cost to speed. If they pay more, they can run faster. And that linear range probably goes up to a million times faster than humans and down to a billion times slower. So what sets the speed is the optimal for a job. So if you're running a super tanker or if you're driving an ordinary car, you can run slow because you don't need to run fast. But in the emulation economy, if everything's changing really fast, then they'll need to run faster in order to keep up. So if the economy, say, doubles every month and they want to fit a subjective career of a century into that month, they'll need to run at least 1,000 times faster than humans. On the other hand, if they're in a big city and they want to interact with anybody in the same city without really noticing where they are, then they need to be running not much faster than 1,000 times human speed. So that's my argument for thinking they run roughly 1,000 times human speed, typically.
So one thing I find fascinating about your approach here is you're an economist. I should have mentioned that at the outset. You're at George Mason and Oxford. And you think about things in cost. You think about things in terms of, realistically, what are the trade-offs going to be and what might come of it? Why might there be different kinds of emulation and how might they function in the real world? You don't see a lot of that in science fiction. Even people that purport to write hard science fiction, for example, Kim Stanley Robinson, one of my favorite authors, writes this great series, the Mars series, that is in many ways hard science fiction. It describes a lot about what we know about how settling Mars would work and terraforming the planet. But when it comes to things like economics, it's complete fantasy.
Right. Most readers don't know that much about economics. Of course, most readers don't know much about physics or computer science. So most science fiction authors don't get much realistic at all, except what their readers would know, because it's hard enough really to write fiction without being realistic about things. There's a smaller subset of science fiction authors who at least, say, try to get the physics right sometime. They take some time to study that, and then they get that right, but they don't get the other stuff right because that's an investment. So their readers might know enough physics to notice whether they get the physics right, but nothing else. So a few writers will know more computer science than most, and they'll try to get that right. But there's just so few readers who know a lot of social science that authors hardly bother to do that. In addition, often when you want to tell a morality tale, social science gets in the way. So physics and computer science don't as often get in the way of the morality tale you want to tell than social science.
Well, so let's get to the morality part in a minute here. But just to make sure we all understand what the age of M is and what these emulators are actually doing, what does the operational state look like? What are these M's doing? How does their world compare to our world?
Emulations are living in a subsistence economy, like a Malthusian world. So mostly they are working most of the time and barely earning enough to survive. What do they need to survive? They need computer hardware. They need energy. They need cooling. They need structural support. They need communication lines, repair bots. These are the things they need to just exist. And in a subsistence economy, you have to work most of the time to pay for that. And that's what they're doing. Most of them are doing the bare minimum. They're making hardware, they're making energy, they're making cooling. Most of them are spending most of their time doing that.
So this isn't the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek fantasy where nobody has to work. This
exactly.
is still an economy. And even the software, they have jobs and they have to sort of cost-benefit decisions and they got to pay their bills.
Yeah. So a lot of people have looked at our trend over the last century of increasing per-person wealth and they've projected that forward and they've thought about what happens in futures with much less scarcity. And they say, what do people do when they're rich and technology is powerful and they can do anything they want? And that's been a popular trend and people talking about that. And that may probably will continue for a while. And even in the age of M, that's true for the humans. It's just not true for the emulations anymore.
Okay, so we're talking a century out. This lasts about a year. It evolves really quickly. So we have many, many generations, just like bacteria can evolve very quickly. And they're coexisting with humans. What do we think is going to happen?
Well, the economy grows very rapidly during this
short
time. The
human economy?
No, the emulation economy. Now, humans start out owning most of this economy. They're the rich capitalists of this world. They can hope that they will just be treated as retirees and allowed to spend their wealth as long as they aren't, you know, too overbearing about it. And then in this short 2 years for the humans, those who don't have any other source of income, they're in trouble. They could starve because you can't work anymore. There's no more jobs. But if you own any wealth, that wealth doubles as fast as the economy. If the economy doubles every month, your wealth doubles every month. So collectively, humans get very rich very fast, but there can't be much cultural change in a year or two. So what are they doing? You already know what they're doing. If you see around you anybody who's ever gotten rich when they're young, and what do they do with their life? Well, that's what the humans will be doing.
So they fritter it away.
Slowly, but yeah.
So I have a sense of what this world looks like. It sounds like it looks a lot like our own world.
So there's a lot of commonality in terms of increasing organization size in cities. So, you know, one of the big differences of our economy from the farming world is we're concentrated into cities more. We're in larger organizations. We have more specialization in our jobs. And that continues to be true for the emulations. They're concentrated into a small number of dense cities. They're in big firms. They have specialized jobs. You know, most of their jobs are office jobs. There's a lot of marketing. There's a lot of lawyers. You know, all of these things continue to exist.
Now, but are these just sitting on thumb drives? Are these in
bodies? They're on server racks mostly. That is, most jobs in an advanced economy are desk jobs. So mostly they do those sitting in virtual reality. They're at a virtual reality desk. Reality just needs to be whatever it takes to make them comfortable and able to do their work. It's really cheap to make it luxurious. So they never need grime or hunger or pain or disease. Their bodies are always beautiful. Their luxurious surroundings are gorgeous, but they're working most of the time.
And they need some luxury because they still feel like humans feel. They want.
Yeah. So, and luxury is cheap. It's easy to give them. Why not?
Right.
So they are just like today in a virtual, in a video game. Video games can just as easily be luxurious as they can be grimy. It doesn't cost any more to make a luxurious video game environment.
So they're basically like us, but they're going to be evolving at a much faster pace culturally.
Yes, and they would be selecting. So there's a huge inequality from, you go from 7 billion humans, and then most emulations are copies of the few hundred most productive humans. So they are very selective, and they are very elite then by compared to most humans. They are as elite as the typical Nobel Prize winner, billionaire, Olympic gold medalist. They're all that good.
So Bernie Sanders is going to love this, right? The top 0.00001%.
Right. So they're really quite elite. But on the other hand, their wage inequality is very low. They all make about the same money. The best, no matter what jobs, the janitor makes as much as the lawyer, makes as much as the CEO.
And ultimately, the economy is being driven by what human beings on the outside are willing to buy?
They're rich retirees, but how much do rich retirees really drive the world? They spend money on luxuries, so their emulations will be building them with yachts and starships and whatever they want, but that won't really drive the economy.
So are humans still working?
No. Humans all lose their jobs, and if they don't have any other source of income, they're in trouble. But if they have sufficient assets, insurance, sharing, then they can live in a nice, comfortable life.
Well, that sounds like a potentially very scary future.
Yes, well, this one great advice is to insure yourself against this sort of future, please arrange for some form of sharing or insurance and don't just expect to survive, you or your children or grandchildren, on your ability to earn wages.
Right. So should we be afraid of this future?
You could be. I mean, it's not my job to make you like it or hate it. My job straight out is just to tell you what it's likely to be. But generically, you might be scared of change. Generically, people through history have been scared of change. And of course, you could laugh at that when it's small amounts of change. When it gets big enough, maybe you have to admit, hey, change can be scary when it's big.
Well, that's the thing, of course, we talk about a lot here on the show, the difference between the stasis mentality that pretty much wants to preserve the world as it is, and people who are dynamists. But yeah, I have to say, I consider myself about as much of a dynamist as anyone. I'm willing to embrace an unknown, an unplannable, messy future. But the future you describe could be pretty terrible if human beings end up starving in the streets.
Absolutely.
Or end up maybe going to war with these intelligences.
So, and consider an analogy with a cultural relativist, right? You might have a person you know who's very proud of traveling to many places in the world and not just being locally tied to, you know, the northeastern Vermont or something. They see a lot of the world and they embrace a lot of the cultures. But if you travel far enough in the world, you'll find cultures even you will pause at and be not so sure you can embrace. You know, there can be things really different. And this is true even more so when we go into the future. The future can just be so different that you might well pause and say, gee, I don't know. This might be too much.
Right. Well, the difficult thing about paradigm shifts is it's always hard to know when you're standing in one paradigm what the next one looks like and what you should do about it.
Right. So I will recommend this book then to people who think they're very comfortable with change, who think they're eager for all the change that's coming. Maybe you haven't seen just how much change could be coming. This would be somewhat of a test for you. Look at this much change and are you comfortable with that?
So what do you think should be done about it? Or since you're an economist and I take your task here to be primarily descriptive, and in some sense, you seem to be arguing that this will just happen. You said today at lunch that economics is mostly a science that concerns what happens when nobody's in charge.
Right.
So is there anything that we really can do about this, or does it not matter? Will it simply delay the inevitable?
So there's a lot you can do at smaller scales. It's about your degree of ambition. If you look at the future and you say, gee, I wanted a future of fairies and dragons, and you've shown me a weird future of robots, I wanted the future of fairies and dragons, I might say to you, at that level of scope, you really can't be in charge. That's just not something we can do. But within a world of roughly a certain description, you can vary some things. You can think about, well, how can my nation be one of the more dominant nations in this new world? Or how can my children prosper in this world? Or how can I set up arrangements so that me and my family and my firms are better insured against things that could go wrong? Those are things you could do, and maybe you should.
So let's tie this to tech policy. So a few months ago, there was a letter signed by leading Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and investors, people like Elon Musk, people who seem like dynamists, who are pro-technology and for the most part have been willing to embrace disruptive innovation. And yet they called for restrictions on radical advances in artificial intelligence. What do you have to say to that, if anything?
I think they have two very different concerns, one of which I think is less likely than they think, and the other, I agree, is pretty much overwhelmingly likely. But the unlikely scenario, I think, is the what they call FOOM, or intelligence explosion, that's local, where some machine in a basement suddenly takes over the world in a weekend. And it's logically possible. I just think it's much less likely than other people think, and we shouldn't put that much effort into it. But some people should. The other scenario I think is overwhelmingly likely is the scenario where our descendants, be they robots or whatever, drift away from us in their values and their preferences such that what they want becomes farther away from what we want. That's what all previous generations of our ancestors has had to put up with. It's what we by default, I suppose, should expect to put up with. But many people say that's unacceptable. They want the future generations to not drift away. And of course, it is true that as change accelerates, we will see farther into the future generations in a shorter time because, you know, as change accelerates, it takes less objective time to see more change. So yes, they think that they want to find a way to arrest change in values and to make sure our descendants don't have different values from us. And it is not a crazy concern. And that's what a lot of what they call AI risk is focused on. I'm, you know, fine with them researching that. I don't have a lot of hope for that. I tend to think we will have to put up with what our ancestors put up with, which is children and descendants that only partially embrace our values.
So do you think there's any low-hanging fruit for governments today? I mean, are there things that we could do to make sure that this future turns out to be a better future?
Well, the main risk for humans is that they suddenly lose their ability to work and they don't have any other source of income. So I definitely will recommend to individuals and families and even local areas that they try to find some sort of insurance or sharing arrangements based on some sort of global source, not just on a local source, because that's probably not going to be enough to tide them over. So that's one thing I would suggest. Another thing I would suggest is that people just stare at the future and try to come to terms with whatever is changeable and deal with that and accept what is not by the old Catholic prayer. God teach me to accept what I can't change and to change what I can, because there's a lot of risk for just very disruptive things happening during this transition. And a lot of people could get hurt and killed during a transition where people are not in some sort of an equilibrium about what is feasible and what changes they can accept.
Well, if we tie this back to you know, 2016, here we are in an election where change is first and foremost on everyone's mind. And at least the discourse suggests that a lot of the reason that people were voting for a Bernie Sanders or a Donald Trump was that they are uncomfortable about the degree of disruption we've already had over the last say 20 years.
Right.
And some people maybe don't want to move from their communities that are not doing well.
And that degree of change is pretty small compared to what we're talking about in the transition to the age of M. So if you're really going to get your, you know, nut, your bun in a nut tied up about that, you're just going to be apoplectic when this new change comes.
So what does that mean for politics then?
It means it would probably be, you know, well, it might be good if people start to anticipate these larger changes and find a way to come to terms with them. Of course, maybe it's better if they just get blindsided because the way they try to anticipate the change is to stop it. So when the age of M comes, probably I predict most places in the world will be cautious. They will like want to study it and go some trials, and they don't want to just let it go wild. But probably the few places who let it go wild, perhaps out of neglect, they will suddenly dominate the earth. The age of M will be located very concentrated in a small number of dense cities, and those could be most anywhere. And they will probably just be wherever they started, wherever things were okay. So that means there's a huge degree of inequality. It also means if there are places where not only did they like go slow, but they even opposed, they tried to prevent it, then once the age of M is dominant, they may resent that. They may resent the humans in the places that like tried to resist them and tried to prevent their age from coming to.
So I was going to ask what you thought this meant for libertarianism. And the most immediate answer, it seems like, is that the dispersion of power, the ability of polities to compete with each other, the ability of whether it's states or governments to experiment and have different approaches to technology regulation sounds really important, because the more concentrated power was, the more that something like this was decided at the level of the European Union, instead of member states, or even the United Nations, the harder it would be for there to be places for this kind of experimentation to succeed.
Right. Now, if you thought global coordination was possible, you might think, well, what we really need to do is accelerate toward a world government so that we have a world government capacity when this sort of thing becomes feasible, so that we can just stop it and make it happen nowhere. If you thought this was such a terrible thing, that's at least a coherent position. You hate it so much, you are so willing to have a very intrusive, powerful world government that makes a lot of mistakes and hurts a lot of people, but manages to coordinate to prevent something like this. That's one scenario. But if you aren't willing to go there, or you think that's not really feasible, then you should think that, okay, this is going to happen, and maybe I want my area to be embracing of it. And yes, now larger scale coordination that mostly coordinates to prevent it locally but not globally is just going to hurt your area, and you might rather you had a more libertarian government locally.
Unless you think this results in people starving in the streets and humans being enslaved.
Well, but again, if that's inevitable globally and you can't stop it globally, it's just a matter of whether it, you know, whether it wins locally or whether it happens somewhere else.
Right. Well, I would just wrap up by saying that, you know, this seems to me to be on a continuum, a very, very large continuum with all the debates that we deal with every day. I mean, if small cities can't get used to the idea that Uber is going to come in and provide a transportation service that doesn't look like a taxi cab service, or the same with Airbnb or vaping or whatever,
then they'll be behind other places. But in our world, we're rich enough that that's okay for a lot of people. When you're rich, you've got a big buffer. You can be conservative and say, no, I don't want change. And your life goes okay. In our world, when you're rich, it's okay to be a little bit behind because you don't lose that much. But the age of M, it is a different world. It's a very competitive world. In the age of M, if you don't keep up with the times, you just go away. So it's a far more rapid displacement of less efficient behaviors by more efficient behaviors. And that's one of the reasons I predict the age of M is somewhat more libertarian. That is, on average, libertarian policies probably are more conducive to production and efficiency locally. We have many efficiency arguments as economists for libertarian policies. Plausibly, on average, that's roughly right. And therefore, just because it's a very competitive world, they will compete themselves into roughly libertarian regimes just because that's the ones that'll win. Now, it's not totally libertarian when there are important, you know, inefficiencies from libertarian policies, when there are key externalities, et cetera, that can be improved on by more central coordination. They'll probably do that, but they'll probably do it in a way that minimizes the many costs, as we know, from government. So it's a more libertarian world. It's also a more engineering-oriented world, if we have a technology audience here. In the last century, we've moved from focus on a small number of products that are produced at a very low cost, at large-scale economies. We moved toward the opposite extreme of very high product variety, very small production runs. And people have enjoyed product and a behavioral variety, and that's increased the importance of design over engineering. because engineering is more about like just getting things at low cost. In the age of M, because they're at a subsistence world, they care much less about variety, much more about just efficiency. So the importance of engineering comes back.
So what happens to design and art?
Well, it's still there. It's just as important as it was, say, two centuries ago. It was just less.
Ah. Well, I'm reminded of when I first started Tech Freedom. 6 years ago, I was asking my friends what they thought I should call the organization. And my first thought was, let's call it the Dynamist Institute. We talk about that all the time. Turns out most people hear Dianetics. That didn't work very well. And so Tech Freedom was the obvious choice. But a friend of mine put it very astutely to me. She said, so is that freedom
from
for? Is that freedom for the Cylons or freedom from the Cylons?
Exactly. It's ambiguous.
And your answer is?
Well, in the age of M, it's the robots who mostly run things, even if they pay their, you know, human overlords retirement benefits. But they're mostly in charge doing things. And in their world, they are the tech. And they are mostly free. But of course, they're as free as most humans have ever been or animals when they live in a subsistence society. That is, physics tells them they must work most of the time. It's not some rude government or taskmaster forcing them to work. It's just the world says, hey, you know, you need to work or you starve.
And do you think they'll listen to podcasts? Do you think they'll care about think tanks?
Oh, sure. They'll need leadership. We already know that humans, to be productive, need time off. They need vacations. They need weekends. They need evenings. So emulations will have all those things, and they'll need distraction. They can't just think about work when they're in the evening. They need to think about something else. So yes, they'll have art. They'll have music. They'll have food. They'll have podcasts.
Well, I hope that this podcast holds up well in 100 years when the all virtual reality version of Tech Freedom is listening on this for its audience, and mostly made up of M's who were the only ones that probably could keep up with exactly where the discourse has gone, because they'll be moving, as you say, many, many times faster than human beings. In the meantime, though, we can all find your book on Amazon. There is an audio version as well.
Yeah, just out apparently. So The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life when Robots Rule the Earth. There's also a website, ageofm.com.
And you're on Twitter?
I am.
Good. Robin Hanson has been my guest today from George Mason University and Oxford University, the most interesting economist I think you'll hear on this show, at least for the foreseeable future. Economics, dismal science, but potentially also extremely exciting.
It could be the future.
Indeed. On that note, thank you for listening. Again, I'm Baron Soka. Evan might or might not return on the next episode. We'll see. Thanks for listening. As always, you can find this show on the iTunes Store. Leave us a review. It'll help others find the show. And make sure to note that we don't just talk about net neutrality all the time or Uber and the sharing economy. We try to go for the really big picture stuff. So maybe we'll have one of the pessimists about this very topic come on the show and explain why we should be terrified and try to shut this down immediately. But that's it for today.
Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.